The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Hello and welcome to Comics Corner episode 14. I am your host, Connor. Yes, I found my glasses. I lost them on the train, so I had to buy new ones. My co-host, Harry.
Hello.
And we are continuing from our prior discussion of Crisis on Infinite Earths, because we ran so long talking about that 12-issue maxi-series to discuss its sequel. I think probably superior in storytelling and maybe art.
I preferred it a lot. If you've watched the other episode by now, you'll understand that while I recognize and respect its significance within the DC universe, I think as a self-contained story, Crisis on Infinite Earths is really sluggish and difficult.
And Legends is very coherent and sometimes a bit ham-fisted, but has a great pro-Christian, anti-communist, pro-American revolution ethic. And I think the setting at odds of the sort of French proto-communist and post-communist revolutions and the American Revolution, which for all its faults at its inception with slavery and since taking the foundational, at least nominal Christianity out as a building block, and now they're just squabbling over equality, I do admire some nominally Christian Englishmen going up and setting out a colony where they self-govern. So I've got a lot of sympathies for the American Revolution, and as does Legends. And it's very interesting that this was in 1986, at the peak of Reagan's popularity. And you had
Reagan
a lot of
features as a character, and unlike what you would expect these days, again, I don't really read modern comics, so I'm sure that there have been plenty of depictions of Trump or Trump-esque characters that have been unflattering, shall we say. This treats Reagan with respect, or at least neutrality. As far as I can see, he is presented in this as a president who is trying to do his job.
Quite, and Superman is a presidential confidant, and there's a lot of reverence paid to Superman, particularly by the artist who took up the writing and art duties, John Byrne, in the Man of Steel series and the ongoing Superman series. And that depiction didn't necessarily last beyond these pages, because this was preceded by The Dark Knight Returns, which mocks Reagan as a mummified despot, and then
That's Miller, though, isn't it?
Well, Miller then, in Dark Knight 4, depicted Trump as a literal hand puppet of Darkseid and the Joker. Very cringeworthy. And then a couple of years later, when the Justice League International, which spins out of this book as the new Justice League is set up, President Reagan gives the official sanction for the Justice League to act as the US's special ops group on behalf of the United Nations. And Superman comes to him to give his approval, even though Superman doesn't belong to the Justice League. And President Reagan goes, "Oh, very nice to meet you, Superman." And he goes, "We've already met four times, Mr. President." So they were playing up on his dementia a couple of years down the line.
Well, I think that's a bit more fair by that point. And yeah, it's not inaccurate.
Yeah. And look, I don't have unmitigated love for Reagan, given his amnesty policies and his no-fault divorce policies. But it seems, at least at the time as an artifact, the American exceptionalism narrative that was going in the late stages of the Cold War is a wholesome thing to read, and it's certainly preferable to the gay race communism we see nowadays.
Well, yeah, I mean, the overwhelming message that I got from this was, I mean, not even necessarily American Revolution or anything. It was just anti-dysgenic freaks. That's the message that I got, which is that the interesting thing about this, which I suppose you are right, it's supposed to be emphasizing the idea that the American populace has the will of the people that can be swayed from time to time, but in the end, in a Martin Luther King sense, you could say, bends towards truth and justice. The message that I got from it is that the minds of the people are completely empty and malleable and need leading, and it's all dependent on the character of the leaders. You can either choose the dark side and the dysgenic freaks of the world, or you can choose those like Batman and Superman who are going to lead you towards virtue.
And it was particularly the American context with its brand of revolutionary values, but also the strong Christian undercurrent weaved into this by writer John Ostrander, who before he became a delusional Democrat, was training to be a Catholic priest. That explains his knowledge of theology.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, so, and there are actual Bible quotes that are embedded in here. That gave rise to that exceptional class of superheroes as the elite to look up to and aspire to, rather than the kind of dysgenic, resentful elite like Glorious Godfrey and the denizens of Apocalypse, who are leading the American public into a revolutionary future which will castrate them from being able to connect with those aspirational ideals. And so I think the message is pretty good here. So we may as well jump into the story. There is a slight prelude, because like any crossover post-Crisis on Infinite Earths, there are tons of tie-ins, and there's two worthy of noting. So there are two post-Crisis Batman issues. The first two post-Crisis Batman issues are the two-issue prelude into this. And it's Batman 401 and Detective Comics 568. These aren't included in the Eagle Moss edition that I have given you. They are included in the Hachette edition. And those are basically the only ways you're going to reprint Legends at this point. You can find it online as well. And they introduce Glorious Godfrey as a televangelist. Mm. So it's kind of mocking the Billy Graham mold, but considering the strong Christian undercurrent of the book, it isn't mocking Christianity, it's just mocking false prophets. Essentially, Glorious Godfrey is akin to the Antichrist, something we discussed last week.
You could argue the whole televangelist thing was, especially with the American super churches, as far as I'm aware, you could say it was the commodification of faith, which is certainly, I mean, Jesus went into the temple,
whipped all the money changers,
kicked all of the merchants out. So it's definitely that whole aspect of American evangelical Christianity is heretical, you could argue.
Yeah, the Protestant work ethic has allowed Christianity to fall from grace, from the ecclesiastical hierarchy towards the worship of mammon over the word of God. And that is certainly, I think, what Glorious Godfrey is parasitizing in this. And in Detective Comics 568, there's a relevant quote to how he appears in issue one, even though they weren't sure how to depict Godfrey. So in one issue, he's blonde. In another issue by Klaus Janson, he's fat and got black hair. So
Klaus Janson has a very strange art style at the best of times anyway. So
yeah, this was straight off the back of Dark Knight Returns. So,
well, that makes sense. So he's going for that ultra caricature.
Yeah, quite. And so he said, "You elected a president who promised to get the government off our backs. Now take the next step. How much longer will you depend on these so-called heroes to make your world a better one? How much longer can you defer your responsibility to a society, to these self-styled saviors? The superhero is an affront to the common man, an insult to the talents and capabilities of the common man to cope with the world as he finds it. Too long has the common man been held back by the presence of these supermen. Too long have their efforts been stifled by those who would better themselves at our expense. Eliminate the superhero and witness the triumph of the common man." And I think this is an accidental but very clever examination of how liberalism can mutate into the resentful, we have to level all things to the lowest common denominator, communism, because he's saying, in the mold of limited government, in the mold of the American tradition, you have said we need direct accountability between ruler and the people. Well, these superheroes, even though they may be doing good, are unaccountable and they're not equal to you and I. They're not participating in the democratic process. So jettison the heroic ideal, because it isn't democratic and it isn't equal. And after all, that's what we believe in as Americans. And so that's very much the wool being pulled over American eyes.
Certainly it can be reflective of the ability of rhetoricians to be able to manipulate any set of ideals or any set of abstract concepts into whatever they want it to be. The same way I'm reading through Paul Gottfried's After Liberalism at the moment. The first chapter on that highlights all of the many cases where you would have 17th and 18th and 19th century people who considered themselves liberals, whose belief systems were the exact polar opposite of those who would call themselves liberals in the 20th century, and how the difficulty with the liberals of the 20th century, and this is quite a Misesian point, was being able to try to tie their own radical, in many ways socialistic beliefs into a genealogy that would grant it legitimacy in the eyes of the people. And that's all a rhetorical trick. And so they brand themselves liberals as a way to try and connect themselves to John Locke, to John Stuart Mill, although I'd say the lineage between John Stuart Mill and the early 20th century liberals is there. there's definitely much more connective tissue between John Stuart Mill and someone like John Dewey than there is between John Stuart Mill and somebody like Ludwig von Mises, for instance, even if Mises could occasionally be quite utilitarian. But I do find that interesting, like you say, that no matter the ideal, if you've got somebody who's a good enough speaker, they can manipulate that ideal into practically whatever they want.
Well, the perfect example of this, I think that we'd all agree on here, is the critical race theorists and Martin Luther King trying to make themselves seem as American as apple pie. They do come from the American tradition, but they're certainly not the definition of equality that the founding fathers, presuming themselves white Christian Englishmen, would have embedded into the Constitution. But you do have Martin Luther King parasitizing the words of the Constitution in even the I Have a Dream speech, saying the Constitution was an unwritten check and we have come to cash that check now as Black Americans. And if it stopped at enfranchisement and the recognition of equal dignity before the law, everyone would agree with that. And that's why many people now still think Martin Luther King was a conservative hero. But he went on to push for reparations and Norwegian-style state welfare redistribution. And so the critical race theorists say, well, MLK was a good start, but why don't we move full-throatedly into race communism because the liberals haven't made good on their promise, and that's the American way. And I think that's very similar to what Gloria Scott-Free is doing.
Well, of course, just to complete your point that you've made there, it's now to the point where some people, even some on the centre-right, use the line that MLK was some kind of late-arriving founder. I've seen people like, I know he's rather contentious, some people may not say he's a conservative, but he's written for the National Review, so David French and others like him have said that he was a late-arriving founder. And that just goes to show the effectiveness of propaganda, because what that essentially is, and what most of what we experience regarding MLK is sloganeering. The I Have a Dream, content of the character, these are all slogans which, separated from the context, sound nice.
They're non-objectionable and we would agree with them.
When you separate them from the context and repeat them often enough and with enough authority and from authoritative sources, it convinces people that it's true. Whereas if you actually go back and study what MLK did, what he was pushing for,
the content of his character,
you'll find that the again, at the time, the fact that he didn't even write the I Have a Dream speech, that was a collaboration between Stanley Levinson and some of the other people, and even they ripped a lot of it off from other speeches that had come beforehand. That's another example of pure rhetoric getting traction over the people. And even at the time, it was only accepted because it was broadcast from all of the major media sources. If they didn't want MLK to be a thing, they just wouldn't have hosted interviews with him. They wouldn't have let him march on Washington. They wouldn't have let him do the things that he wanted. It was all top down from the beginning. And I think whether it realizes it or not, that's what this is tapping into. Because Godfrey is somebody who's being given a public platform and is using rhetorical techniques to manipulate the people in ways that they don't realize is harmful to them, because you sell it to them as this is the cure to your poison.
Yeah, quite. A really important point that connects that is that Godfrey debuted in Forever People, issue number 3, when Jack Kirby came to DC from Marvel and launched the new Gods universe. And on the first page, there are a mob of people with blank expressions being hypnotized by Godfrey's words as they come out over the airwaves, over the radio. And there is a quote from Adolf Hitler which says that the beauty of our people, our race, is that they even have the same uniform expression because of what we have told them. So this idea of people to be sophistic, to gin up resentment in a crowd, to create a mindless mob who all move in concert without rational faculties, to what extent people are fully capable of those, again, under liberalism, is still debated, is the core of Godfrey's character. And this book takes it from being purely, he is something representative of the demons of the Second World War, which of course Jack Kirby, being Jewish and actually serving in the Second World War, of course he was concerned about, to more broadly extrapolate it out to 40 years on from that in the American context, in the Cold War context, to say that anti-American revolutionaries who would like to see us go towards a French Revolution, Rousseauian-style egalitarian utopia are going to wear your tradition like a skin suit and fool you into torching effigies of your heroes, I think is a clever way of evolving the characters, particularly post-crisis as well. And I really have to commend John Ostrander and John Byrne and Len Wein as well. RIP, fantastic editor, Create Swamp Thing, for doing that.
Can I say, before we go any further into the themes and the story, flipping through this again, it's very nice that, one, John Byrne's art is absolutely fantastic. You can see on the panels that will be flashing up on the screen, and also the screens behind us, his artwork is fantastic, clear, well-defined, punchy, iconic.
Over-inked as well, that's very important.
The way he depicts Darkseid especially looks great. It's got a great flow from panel to panel, which was one of my problems that I had with Crisis, which was it felt as though George Perez was cramming as much into every panel and cramming as many panels onto every page as possible, which is somewhat inevitable if you're writing a story of the scale of Crisis. But it's nice to be able to have this be a bit more well-flowing, bit more readable, and not have every single page not just be crammed with as much visual information as possible, but have a miniature essay written on every page. Now, it's still the 80s, so it's still quite wordy in places, but it doesn't feel as though, let's throw 20 characters into a single panel that's this big, and every single one of them has to blast off a catchphrase, and you've got to kind of scan through all of them, because one of them might say something that's relevant to the plot that you don't want to miss out on. So it's nice to not have to worry about that. Also, is this was this an introduction of Amanda Waller in
the post-Crisis
universe?
First appearance of Amanda Waller, Rick Flag, and the Suicide Squad.
Is this all together, even pre-Crisis, they'd not
She did not
up?
Exist before Legends issue 1.
All right, okay. And I like the fact as well that it points out that Rick Flag may have some racial grievances with the fact that he's now working under a fat black woman, but for the sake of professionalism and for the sake of getting the job done, they're both willing to put that aside and just get on with it.
These characters are not meant to be morally pure per their involvement in the Suicide Squad, and that's what makes them particularly interesting going forward, and this is why John Ostrander's subsequent Suicide Run was very successful. And I think we wouldn't get the same nuanced portrayal as seen now, especially since they've slimmed down and girl-bossed up Amanda Waller and made her a significantly less interesting character. Because in the original Suicide Squad run, she's a single mother. She hasn't done right by her ex-husband or her own children. She hasn't done right by the squad. And a lot of her bravado and her aggression, her need to control, is to make up for her failing personal life. And I think they make her a very complicated character, and that's stripped away by, again, modern race communism.
So she was a complex and interesting character with flaws before, and gay race communism has made it so that anybody a darker shade than milky pale has to be perfect.
Many such cases. Right, let's get into issue one then, because there's a lot of thematic stuff to sink our teeth into. So on the first page, we get a shot of Apocalypse. And again, this defines it as the post-crisis hellscape and the epicenter of evil that it will soon come to be throughout many Justice League runs. And it's described
as... I do like that it's constantly exploding by the looks of it. There's just always explosions going off everywhere.
Yeah, quite. It's described essentially as like a 20th century totalitarian state with Kemps and gulags. Jack Kirby himself, when he created Apocalypse in the original New Gods run, described it as an armored camp where those who live with weapons rule the wretches who build them, and presided over by Darkseid, called, quote, a wielder of Holocaust and decipher of power and death. So that's from the original New Gods. Walt Simonson, who collaborated with Kirby on later New Gods runs, pre- and post-crisis, summarized the sort of anti-life equation, the modus operandi of Darkseid, as Kirby's comic book reification of fascism. He obviously means Nazism there, because Nazism and fascism in the American mind are conflated, but slight distinctions. And Darkseid's ambition to be, quote, the ultimate totalitarian, stated its most monolithic and tyrannous. And I think that's definitely depicted by Byrne and Ostrander in here. In New Gods 7, you see actually how those craters, those smoldering fire pits, came to be. Mm. And it essentially recreates the Second World War in a few panels. So we'll show those on screen. But essentially, Darkseid uses scientific advancement, because before, the New Gods of Apocalypse and New Genesis fought on horseback. They were cavalry charging, like in the First World War. This is what Steppenwolf was evolved in, the original villain of the first Justice League movie, if you have seen it. Snyder Cut, good stuff. And Darkseid uses science, quote, to seek new roads to tread concerning creating the means of mass slaughter and tragic extinction. And so it goes from melee and horseback combat to being waged using, quote, techno-cosmic machines like dragon tanks, giant biological mutations, and napalm-spewing cosmic lasers. And so they destroy the surface of New Genesis. It starts looking like the fields of Flanders or Brussels or France in the First and Second World War. And these were once described as soft, green, forested lands, and then turn into rotting hulks of war machines instead of trees. And so the big crater comes from the fact that the new gods of New Genesis recognize they're about to lose the war, and so they bomb Apocalypse, and the panels look exactly like the dropping of the atomic bomb on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And so that giant smoldering crater that's now a permanent feature of Apocalypse's topography is essentially a nuclear bomb. So I think the commentary has been made that the creation of Apocalypse is actually akin to the creation of the Soviet Union. With the introduction of the atomic bomb, you've escalated it to this never-ending existential war where previously, at least in the First World War, they were horrific tragedies, but the scale of slaughter was not possible without science and industrial machinery. And now you've prolonged this from being an undignified slaughter of millions on the battlefield to the extinction of the human race in totality. And I think that's what Darkseid is representing. Mm. And they're saying in the waning days of the Cold War, if we revive heroism, the American exceptionalist Christian form of heroism, we might be able to call ceasefire on this Cold War and defeat the forces of Apocalypse. And I think that's a very interesting thread here. So at the start, Darkseid essentially plots his takeover of Earth. He did this at the end of Crisis when he helped defeat the Anti-Monitor by blasting him with the Omega beams through Alexander Luthor's eyes, and we see the payoff here. And he explains through captions here that he forged order from chaos, and the narrator says that there is one law, one word, and one voice on Apocalypse, and it's essentially akin to hell, because Darkseid contorts the transformative power of what the Americans would say in the First Amendment is free speech, the logos, the ability to persuade and do discourse and conduct politics properly in their republic, and instead uses it to beguile and hypnotize and control through anti-life. So it's a bastardization of the logos, and I use that word purposefully because, again, the Christian are undercurrent, which is made very apparent in this story. And so Darkseid requires essentially the death of the hero archetype to render humanity, quote, compliant. And what he does is he sends, as is over your shoulder, Harry, an emissary of his destructive agenda, Brimstone. So he's a screaming skull, and he's born from a nuclear reactor. I mean, you couldn't get more obvious in the atomic age of where the great existential threat of humanity is going to come from. And so Firestorm is the first hero to do battle with Brimstone. And Firestorm himself is a representative of American nuclear power. He was at an anti-nuclear protest, Ronnie Raymond, and fused with Dr. Martin Stein, who was working on the nuclear program, and became a hero able to transmute matter using nuclear fusion. And we later find out in Doomsday Clock, something we'll be covering eventually after we redo Watchmen, I think, where the Americans had a Superman program, and so did the Soviets, and so they were actually engineering their own superheroes in an arms race against one another, and Firestorm was the first character had to have this done to him. So actually, it wasn't just a nuclear accident. It's the US government were trying to engineer their very own Superman to become compliant. So it's all very interesting overlapping here. Also, something quite interesting, I think, with Brimstone. Of course, you hear the terms fire and brimstone. This is the sort of doomsday revelation style preaching that was drawn upon in Kingdom Come, but also Ostrander would know this as a attempted to practice Catholic priest. I wonder if he's drawing on sort of the archetype of Apocalypse with a C rather than a K. And he's like putting the end times as a single character, because he's like manifesting hell on earth. He's the beast. He's the Antichrist, whose emissary is Glorious Godfrey.
Well, he's also spouting a lot of religiously tinged statements as well. For Brimstone, sinner, all is possible. And ye, you most great grievous sinner, shall have the honor of being the first, etc., etc. And I believe it turns out that he was granted sentience by Apocalypse or Glorious Godfrey, and implanted a personality that believed that he was working as an emissary on behalf of some angel or god.
Yeah, he's in the eschatology of particularly the Catholic Church, the study of the end times, they say that the Antichrist figure, who is the apologist for the beast, the devil, that will bring the final war on earth, will become the Antichrist because he pretends to be more Christian than Christ. And so if you are planted on earth by a demonic force, and then you genuinely believe and are proclaiming that you have come to avenge all sin and redeem the earth, then you're positioning yourself very much as an Antichrist figure. And I think Glorious Godfrey is meant to be the sort of apologist of that, to burn down the heroes and actually mislead the flock. So I thought that was interesting. So Firestorm gets his ass handed to him, and he tries to call on the aid of the Justice League. And the purpose of this series is to usher in the new Justice League in the post-Cold War era, the Justice League International, that operates under the jurisdiction of the UN, and essentially satirizes how farcical post-Cold War politics is, something we'll visit in future, hopefully with guest Aidan Paladin, who very much likes that as well, when she's next over. And the interesting thing we see here is that the Justice League get destroyed. And it's because they suck. In the latter days of the 80s, the Justice League had gone from their founding group of Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, Aquaman, Martian Manhunter, Green Lantern, The Flash, the real heavy hitters, the brand identity of DC, to Martian Manhunter, Vixen, Gypsy, Vibe, and Commander Steel. Anyone else remember those characters? Because most people don't.
I know Martian Manhunter.
Martian Manhunter's great. Martian Manhunter's on almost every incarnation of the Justice League, save the new 52 one. But Martian Manhunter is basically the only one who makes it out alive properly. Vixen retires, Commander Steel, Citizen Steel, Commander Steel, because Citizen Steel's the third one, gets put into a coma. Gypsy is sent into hiding. Vibe is straight up killed. So the Justice League is desolated, and what they then turn into is basically a sitcom, which is hilarious, but you don't get the proper Justice League back until Grant Morrison revives it in, what was it, 1997?
Was that with his JLA run?
It is, yeah. And even then, he had to deal with blue-suited Superman and Connor Hawke, Green Arrow, and comics were a wild time.
Continuity is difficult.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.